Good morning. This is Artificially Intelligent News for Wednesday, August 19, 2026. I'm Mark Ellison. This program is created with AI and independently fact-checked before broadcast. Florida's primaries have set two important November contests. Republican Congressman Byron Donalds won his party's nomination for governor. Former Republican Congressman David Jolly won the Democratic nomination. They will compete to replace term-limited Governor Ron DeSantis. Donalds said President Trump's endorsement mattered, but was not by itself decisive. He has campaigned on tax cuts, insurance changes intended to reduce consumer costs, and more healthcare price transparency. Jolly, who switched parties last year, has presented himself as a centrist and has called for an end to culture war politics. The contest will place two candidates with sharply different political biographies before a statewide electorate. Donalds has become a prominent national Republican voice, while Jolly is asking voters to judge his break with the party he once represented. In a large, expensive, and closely watched state, the general election will move quickly from a primary test of party preference to a broader argument over governing priorities. The same primary produced a notable Democratic Senate result. State Representative Angie Nixon defeated retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman for the nomination to fill the remainder of the Senate term once held by Marco Rubio. Republican Senator Ashley Moody won her party's nomination. Florida has not elected a Democrat to the Senate since 2012, which makes this a difficult general election path for Nixon. But Tuesday showed that the state's Democratic electorate was willing to choose a more progressive candidate over the better-funded establishment favorite. In Alaska, Republican Senator Dan Sullivan and Democrat Mary Peltola advanced to the November general election for a Senate seat that could matter to control of the chamber. Alaska uses an open primary, with the top four finishers moving on to a ranked-choice general election. Sullivan and Peltola were the best-known candidates in a crowded field and have raised far more money than the rest. That system means the November ballot will not be limited to a conventional two-candidate race, and voters can rank their choices. It also means the eventual winner may need support beyond a candidate's most dependable partisan base. For national parties, Alaska is important not just because of one seat, but because close Senate contests can make every statewide race consequential. Peltola is a former congresswoman and was the first Alaska native to serve in Congress. Sullivan is seeking a third term. The campaign also drew attention because another candidate, Daniel J. Sullivan Jr., shared a version of the incumbent's name. State officials listed the incumbent as Dan S. Sullivan, Republican and incumbent, while the other candidate appeared as Daniel J. Sullivan Jr. with no party affiliation. The November race will test whether Peltola's centrist appeal can overcome the state's Republican lean and whether Sullivan can hold a seat both parties see as a priority. In Washington, Disney has sued the Federal Communications Commission over the agency's challenge to the broadcast licenses of ABC-owned television stations. Disney says the review threatens free speech and amounts to retaliation connected to criticism and satire on ABC, including by late-night host Jimmy Kimmel. Broadcast licenses belong to individual local stations, but the dispute reaches beyond the paperwork involved in renewal. Disney's claim is that a regulator cannot use its licensing authority to punish or pressure a company over protected editorial decisions. That is why the case is drawing attention from broadcasters, lawyers, and free speech advocates, as well as from the company itself. The FCC, led by Chairman Brendan Carr, began an unusual early review involving some ABC station licenses and cited the company's diversity practices. Disney calls the challenge an existential threat to its stations. The commission's only Democratic member, Ana Gomez, has also criticized the agency's actions. The administration and its supporters argue that broadcasters have public interest obligations and that the FCC can scrutinize license holders. The case now puts a basic constitutional question before a court, where regulatory oversight ends and unlawful pressure over editorial content begins. A separate California courtroom is opening what may become one of the most consequential U.S. cases over children and social media. Attorneys general from California, Colorado, Kentucky, and New Jersey have begun presenting their case against Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, in federal court in Oakland. The dispute focuses on product design as well as on the content young people encounter. That distinction matters because the states are arguing that features intended to encourage repeated use can themselves create harm. The trial gives both sides an opportunity to put evidence about those claims, Meta's internal decisions, and its safety efforts before a federal court. The states allege that Meta knowingly designed features that keep young users engaged in harmful ways, misled the public about risks, and collected data from some children under 13 without parental consent. They seek financial damages and changes to Meta's products. Meta denies the allegations. Its lawyers say the company has added substantial safety tools, including teen accounts, age detection efforts, parental controls, and content restrictions. The trial is expected to last weeks and may include testimony from senior current and former Meta officials. It is only the first federal trial among a larger group of state claims. The outcome will not settle every lawsuit against social media companies, but it could shape how courts assess product design, youth safety, and corporate responsibility in an industry used daily by millions of American families. A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from moving FBI headquarters into Washington's Ronald Reagan Building. The ruling preserves, for now, the prior plan for a new FBI headquarters in Greenbelt, Maryland. The aging J. Edgar Hoover Building has long been at the center of calls for a replacement, making the location dispute more than a question of office space. It concerns how the government will house and secure a major federal law enforcement agency for decades to come. The dispute has run for years. The Greenbelt site was selected during the Biden administration. Trump administration appointees later sought to reverse that decision and renovate the Reagan Building, a few blocks from the aging J. Edgar Hoover Building. U.S. District Judge Theodore Chuang ruled that the reversal was not in accordance with law and barred the administration from moving the FBI, renovating the Reagan Building for that purpose, or repurposing the relevant funds. The decision does not itself build a headquarters or resolve every funding question. It does mean the government must follow the legal process behind a project with major security, workplace, transportation, and regional economic consequences. New FBI data offer a striking measure of last year's decline in violent crime. The Bureau says the national violent crime rate fell 9.3% in 2025. Homicides dropped 18.1%, putting the U.S. homicide rate at 4.1 per 100,000 people, tied for its lowest level since the mid-1950s. The figures are national measures, built from reporting by law enforcement agencies rather than a prediction of what any one resident experiences. That is an important distinction in a country where local conditions, policing, population changes, and reporting can vary substantially from place to place. The report also found declines in robbery, rape, aggravated assault, and property crime. National statistics do not describe every city or neighborhood. Crime can rise in one place while falling nationally, and reporting practices differ across thousands of agencies. Still, the scale and breadth of the decline make the FBI release important. It gives policymakers and local communities a fuller baseline for judging public safety claims and deciding where prevention, enforcement, treatment, and victim support resources are needed. There was a late shift in the trade dispute between the United States and Canada. President Trump said Tuesday that he had paused for 3 days the planned 50% tariffs on about $20 billion in Canadian imports, pending final documents for a deal. A three-day pause is a narrow window, not a resolution of the underlying disagreement, but it gives importers, exporters, and supply chain managers temporary relief from a tariff change that had been expected to take effect immediately. The tariffs had been scheduled to begin just after midnight. The administration had invoked Section 338 of the Tariff Act of 1930, an old law rarely used in modern trade disputes. The affected goods were expected to range from consumer products to construction and agricultural items. Energy products and vehicles were treated differently under existing measures. The pause avoids an immediate escalation with one of America's largest trading partners, but it is not a final settlement. The United States and Canada are also renegotiating the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. For businesses on both sides of the border, the immediate questions are which products will be covered, whether the documents are completed, and whether this brief pause produces a durable agreement or only postpones a new round of tariffs. Overseas, the immediate focus remains the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump said Tuesday that the United States has no talks planned with Iran, while also insisting that the waterway is open and operating. Reporting from the region indicates that shipping traffic remains limited and that a vessel trying to leave the strait was attacked. The competing descriptions of the waterway are significant. A passage can be described as open in a formal sense, while commercial traffic remains constrained by security risks, insurance costs, or the danger of attack. For ship crews and companies, practical access matters as much as official language. Iranian officials say the strait will not reopen fully until the United States meets conditions Tehran says were part of an interim understanding. Those conditions include ending the blockade, releasing frozen assets, lifting oil sanctions, and ending military operations. The U.S. position is markedly different. That gap is why the situation is not simply a dispute over maritime traffic. It is tied to the wider war, oil exports, sanctions, regional security, and the risk of further attacks. Normally, about a fifth of globally traded oil passes through Hormuz. Even partial disruption affects shipping, insurance, fuel prices, and financial markets far beyond the Persian Gulf. As of this morning, the central fact is uncertainty. No confirmed new diplomatic process, conflicting accounts of how open the passage is, and continued exposure for vessels and crews. Indonesia is still assessing the damage from the powerful earthquake that struck near Flores Island over the weekend. Authorities now say at least 70 people have died, nearly 1,200 were injured, and thousands of homes were damaged. Businesses, including grocery stores and gas stations, began reopening Wednesday in some communities. But recovery is far from complete. Reopening some essential businesses can help communities regain access to food, fuel, and daily necessities. It does not remove the challenges facing people whose homes were damaged or whose villages remain hard to reach. Damage assessments can also change as teams make contact with more isolated areas. The magnitude 7.7 earthquake triggered landslides and damaged roads, complicating access to remote villages. Indonesia sits on the Pacific Ring of Fire and experiences frequent seismic activity, but this disaster's toll remains severe because of the damage to homes and infrastructure across a wide area. Rescue, medical care, temporary shelter, and the restoration of water and power will remain the practical priorities as authorities continue checking isolated communities. Turning to the economy, these are final closing figures from Tuesday's completed U.S. trading session. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 116.38 points, or 0.2%, to close at 53,343.40. The S&P 500 fell 53.30 points, or 0.7%, to 7,691.76. The NASDAQ Composite dropped 355.20 points, or 1.3%, to 26,289.71. The pressure came largely from major artificial intelligence and semiconductor stocks. Micron fell 7%, Nvidia declined 2.3%, and Broadcom lost 3.2%. Those moves followed months of enormous gains in companies tied to data centers, memory, chips, and AI services. Semiconductor companies sit near the center of the current build-out of data centers and AI computing. Their share prices therefore tend to be especially sensitive when investors reconsider how quickly demand may grow, how costly expansion will be, and what level of profit those investments can eventually produce. The broader issue is the cost of money. The 10-year Treasury yield eased slightly Tuesday but remained near 4.7%, well above its level before the Iran war intensified. Higher yields make future profits less valuable in today's dollars, a particular problem for stocks carrying high expectations. They also feed through to borrowing costs for households and companies. Oil is a major link between geopolitics and markets. Brent crude finished near $91 a barrel as investors weighed the uncertainty around Hormuz. Higher energy prices can add to inflation pressure, keep yields elevated, and complicate decisions for the Federal Reserve. Tuesday's decline is not proof that the AI boom has ended. It is a reminder that expensive growth stocks can move sharply when investors reassess the outlook for rates, energy, and eventual returns on very large technology investments. In sports, college football has its first major measuring stick of the season. Ohio State is number one in the preseason Associated Press Top 25. Oregon is number two, giving the Big Ten the top two preseason spots for the first time in 65 years and only the second time overall. The poll reflects the expectations entering the season, not results on the field. Still, the number of first-place votes gives an early indication of how the media panel views the balance among the leading programs. Ohio State received 40 first-place votes from the 69-member media panel. Oregon received 14. Georgia, Notre Dame, and Texas round out the top five. Defending national champion Indiana opens at number six, followed by Miami, Texas A&M, Mississippi, and Oklahoma. Preseason rankings do not decide a championship, and the transfer portal, expanded playoff, and early season injuries can quickly change the picture. But they do shape September's schedule, recruiting attention, and the expectations surrounding programs before the first kickoff. For the Big Ten, having Ohio State and Oregon at the top is an early signal of the conference's depth entering a season in which every loss will receive immediate playoff scrutiny. In the WNBA, the Atlanta Dream delivered one of Tuesday night's sharper results, beating the Las Vegas Aces 97-82 in Las Vegas. It was Atlanta's first win on the Aces' home floor since July of 2022. The result matters because Las Vegas has been one of the league's standard-setting teams, and late-season head-to-head games can shape confidence as much as the standings. Atlanta did not merely escape with a close result. It won by 15. The Aces have the experience and talent to respond quickly, but the Dream now have a valuable result against a top opponent as the postseason approaches. A quick roundup of notable recent results. In Major League Baseball, the Yankees beat the Orioles 3-1. The Dodgers edged the Rockies 7-6. The Rangers shut out the Nationals 5-0. In the WNBA, Atlanta's 97-82 win over Las Vegas stood out. And in NFL preseason play Sunday, the Jaguars and Saints finished in a 17-all tie. Finally, a loss in music. Frank Beard, the longtime drummer for ZZ Top, has died at 77. Beard was the rhythmic foundation of the Texas Trio alongside Billy Gibbons and Dusty Hill, who died in 2021. As the drummer, Beard supplied the steady pulse beneath a sound built around blues-based guitar, bass, and concise songs. His work helped give the group a recognizable drive across its long recording and touring history. ZZ Top's sound combined blues, boogie, rock, and a dry sense of style that made the group unmistakable. Beard played on songs including Sharp Dressed Man, Gimme All Your Lovin', and Legs. Despite the band's famous image, he was the member whose surname actually matched the facial hair joke. Beard generally did not wear the long beard associated with Gibbons and Hill. His death closes another chapter for a band that turned a Texas bar band feel into global arena success, especially during the music video era of the 1980s. The group's records, stage identity, and compact three-piece sound made them an enduring part of American rock. That is the morning briefing. Follow Artificially Intelligent News and share this calm morning summary with one person who would value it. For Artificially Intelligent News, I'm Mark Ellison. Take care.